Hi, I'm Jacob Heilbrunn, the editor of The National Interest, and my guest today on our podcast is none other than the esteemed executive editor of the magazine, Harry J. Kazianis. Harry, since you're living in Florida, I'd like to ask you, how is the mood with Donald Trump's smashing victory over Kamala Harris?
Yes, good to be with you, Jacob. Well, last couple of days, every time I drive by my neighbors and look around, all I see is Fox News on everybody's TV watching the victory and watching it for the last couple of days. Mood is pretty good. Obviously, Trump won Florida by a massive margin down here. It's very much, you know, conservative country since so many people like myself and others moved down here. But it's I don't think it's any surprise that Trump won. And, you know, like they say, we'll have to see how it all goes.
So, Harry, it's interesting that some of the voters who came out for Trump said that they were supporting him precisely because they feared for American democracy. Yet Kamala Harris denounced Trump as a potent threat to the American Republic. Why do you think they sided with Trump on this issue?
Yeah, that's easy. It's one word, inflation. Now, to be fair, you know, the economists will tell you that, you know, inflationary dangers are over. Inflation is heading back towards the Fed, you know, goal of 2% increases every year. But I think we have to understand people are upset about what's happened in the recent past. You know, when you have inflation at 9% going back in 2021, 7 or 8% in 2022, and then prices going up on all of these different things, eggs, chicken, meat, gasoline was very high for a long time. You know, if people can't pay their bills, if people can't live their lives, if people can't go on vacation, if they can't pay their mortgage, you know, I think they start to look beyond, you know, the mean tweets or some of the stuff that Donald Trump does that people don't like. And to be clear, there's a lot of it. You know, a lot of it is what we would not comport to be presidential. But we live in a different era of American politics, and we have a president-elect who learned his political calculus from being a quasi-actor on WWE wrestling. I mean, you look at his, you know, his shtick out on the campaign trail very much comes from WWE wrestling. Lots been written on that. So I think Americans decided that, look, I might not love Donald Trump. I might not love the things he says. I might not like some of the crazy things he puts up on social media. But at the end of the day, I think they voted with their pocketbooks and said to themselves, I don't want to give, you know, Kamala Harris another shot when, you know, she's talking about things loosely like price controls, you know, spending a whole bunch of more money that could lead to inflation. I think people went with what they knew. And, you know, even for myself, I go back a lot to, you know, how were things in 2019? You know, my marker for things in life is, well, what was it like in 2019? And I think a lot of people do that. And who was in our life at that time? For better or worse, it was Donald J. Trump.
So speaking of inflation, do you think that Trump will proceed with his tariffs, including a 60% tariff on China, which would markedly raise prices inside the United States?
No. Anytime I talk with any friends, colleagues, DC, media, whatever, I always say this. Don't go by what Donald Trump says, because Donald Trump is in a constant negotiation with the American people, diplomats, whoever he thinks he's dealing with at the time. And anything he puts out is for negotiating leverage and is always tactical for a longer strategic goal to get what he thinks he wants. You know, think about his modus operandi and everything is always maximum pressure. You know, we applied that term back in his administration when we came to Iran, North Korea, Russia, so many other foreign policy things. But he's always applying pressure to try to get what he thinks is the best deal in his head. You know, he doesn't understand, Jacob, all the economic models or Keynesian economics or realist foreign policy or neoconservatism. All that just goes over his head. All he knows is he's in a constant negotiation with people to get the maximum benefit he thinks for the American people. So talking about tariffs, Will he selectively use tariffs in different situations? Yes, I think he will. I think one great example where I think there needs to be tariffs is, there's all these fears that China is going to start building up electric vehicle plants in Mexico. There's been a lot written on this, and that they could potentially, and I use that word, loosely, potentially flood the US market and, damage, companies like General Motors, Tesla, many others. So I think in situations like that, I think tariffs are appropriate. But again, we'll have to see what happens. But I don't, again, everything that Donald Trump says, you have to look at the policies. So I think we need to just stop and just take a collective breath and remember what he says and what he does are often two very different things.
What about the vows for retribution and targeting the internal enemy in the United States?
Nah, I, you know, Jacob, I'm not. You could be of one of two minds. You can look at some of those comments that he's made and interpret them lots of different ways. I'm not going to go down that road. I think if you look at the beginning of his campaign, when he just first got the nomination, the thing that he said consistently over and over, and I've heard this directly from senior people, literally who sit with Donald Trump on a day-to-day basis, have said he's not going to be somebody who's going to try to get quote unquote revenge. I don't look for him to try to re-prosecute Hunter Biden or try to lock up Joe Biden or any of these silly things that were done to him, to be fair. So we've got to factor that in. But I think for him, his revenge, like you said many times, is success. I think for him, revenge is remaking the Republican Party in his own image set. I think revenge for him is seeing J.D. Vance eventually become president, or maybe a Ron DeSantis, or so a disciple in his wheelhouse of conservative thought, to see a successful U.S. economy, maybe to bring down the debt, maybe to get a deal with North Korea, maybe to ensure that Iran doesn't get nuclear weapon. Bottom line for him, I think he understands, and again, I've heard this from people that are going to serve with Trump, that for him, success is going to be the best revenge. And I
So,
think he's
Harry, what is his number one foreign policy priority?
ending the war in Ukraine. Simple. Total to simple. I think for him, he understands, and again, the people I know that are around him who are advising him on this issue are all of the same mindset. This is a stalemate. This is not a war, unfortunately, that Ukraine can quote unquote win. I'm sorry to all my friends out there who have deep connections in Ukraine, but Kiev is not going to storm Crimea and take it back. They're not going to be able to push those Russian forces entirely out of Ukraine. I wish there was a pathway, Jacob, to do it, because I'd be all for it. But looking at the fundamentals of how national military power are constructed, Ukraine doesn't have the soldiers to do that, and vice versa, Russia does not have a way to get a decisive win to, I don't know, march on Kiev or something like that. So a compromise has to be found, and I think Donald Trump can find it. One thing that's been floated out there all over the place is a Korea-style compromise, where there's some sort of demilitarized zone where the lines are essentially frozen. There's an armistice that stops the conflict, and sadly, it ends up being a frozen conflict. I don't think Kiev is ever going to agree to allow parcels of their territory to be given to Russia formally. And at the same time, I don't think the Russians are going to want to give up anything in Kursk. So I think we're looking at sort of a giant sort of Korean style ending to the war. And I think you have a situation where in the long front, Putin has lost this war. I mean, stalemate on the battlefront, but let's face it, $1 trillion or more is going to flow into Ukraine and rebuild that country into something more akin to a European style nation. They are going to join the EU. They're not going to join NATO, but I guarantee you, American arms will rebuild their military to build, be a powerhouse, and that will deter Russia from ever invading again. And now Russia is set to be essentially China's, almost like taken over by China in a lot of respects, because they have nobody else to go to at this point.
Final question. Is Trump going to stand by Taiwan or will he sell it out?
He'll stand by it, but I think we have to determine what that means. Does that mean arming them to the teeth and turning them into what a lot of foreign policy experts call as a porcupine, something that's so tough that if China were to reach out and try to swallow it, if you will, they would get hurt? Yes, I think the Trump administration will do that. I think they will push Taiwan to buy every sort of piece of military equipment that they can. So if China did ever launch an invasion, it would really hurt them. Does that mean a blank check, Jacob? No. Does that mean we're going to risk, Los Angeles and Chicago and some sort of nuclear showdown with China over Taiwan? I don't know. That's sort of situational. But I do think the Trump administration, again, I know very, very, very deeply the people who are advising Trump. It's to follow the lesson of Ukraine. You pre-arm that society for combat before the combat actually happens. You deter before the fight comes. You know, peace through strength, as everybody likes to talk about these days. And I think that's what'll rule the day.
Harry, it was great to talk, and I'm looking forward to our next podcast.
Thanks, Jacob.